Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have John Bristow, formerly from Microsoft, now a technical evangelist at Telerik, and I have John Galloway from Microsoft. John and John, how are you both?
Very well, thank you.
The same.
John, yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
We're very excited to have you. Now John Galloway, you're in California.
That's true.
And John Bristow, you're in Australia.
Yes, that's right. I'm in the what would be known as the California of Australia. So I'll let you I'll let that one sink in for a couple of seconds.
I'm going to work on that. And you're 14 hours ahead of me, which means you're 17 hours ahead of John.
There you go. Yep, we're living in the future here, man. This is magical, mystical world up here.
Were you 7 hours behind John? I can't. It's very confusing.
No, it's ahead.
It's right? Ahead because of the international dateline. Because you're tomorrow morning.
So tell us what's going on. You can tell us about the Xbox then, the big Xbox announcement.
That's right. Yeah, I have the new iPhone 5 S, I believe it's called, and I think it's the new Xbox as well. And life is great here. You guys can't imagine what it's going to be like when you guys get to the future.
That's very sad. So John, what is it you do for? Let's start with for Telerik. What is it you do?
Yeah, sure. So I'm officially known as a developer evangelist, which I guess if you ask five different people, you get five different answers of what a developer evangelist does. Basically, I kind of boiled it down because I've been doing developer evangelism for almost 9 years now. I boil it down to this one statement. It's basically trying to help developers be better developers. I've kind of loosely coined it, be more awesome. But basically, my job is to help developers better understand the stacks that they target. And I do that a number of different ways. I'll pair program with developers. I'll write samples. I'll listen to some of the things that they're targeting. More often than not, it's actually a problem that's deeper down in the OS or some network configuration problem or something like that. That's really the ultimate result or problem that they're targeting. But generally speaking, I mean, like I'm there to be the public face to Telerik, to be out in the community. I speak a lot at conferences. I write a lot of blog posts. I'm a bit of a weird character on Twitter. That's okay. It gives me a sounding board for my kind of off-color sense of humor. But everything I do is technically focused. So I get a great deal of satisfaction helping developers be better and helping answer their questions. So that's basically about it.
Well, that was a pretty good summary of what a developer evangelist does. I don't know about you, John Galloway, but you know, I find myself struggling to answer that same question.
Yeah, it's a harder, you know, it's a harder thing to both describe and do than it sounds like. You know, it seems you're expected to know about everything. You're supposed to know about what's, you know, things that aren't released yet, but also people ask you things about your product from years ago. And you're expected to know that immediately, and you're expected to know everything about shipping code, but you're also supposed to be ready to speak about anything at any time. And people don't realize how much effort it takes to be able to speak about, you know, to give a good talk. Pretty much nobody that I know can just get up in front of a group and rattle stuff off without a lot of preparation. So that takes, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you're hacking on something that you're about to talk about constantly, it's very difficult to just walk up and wing it. But yeah, you're absolutely right, John. It's just one of those things where when I was at Microsoft, because I used to be at Microsoft, I got questions from everything to why isn't the linker working with, you know, this or you know, why is the kernel doing this in Windows? Everything from that to, you know, what's the HTML5 support in IE10 going to look like? And we were just shipping IE9. I'm like, I don't know. So, you know, so it is a challenge, but I love it. It's great. There's kind of those topics that you're just like, oh God, I don't want to talk about this anymore. But you know, it's all good. You know, I think developers, you know, I think everyone is like any other facet in life. Everyone's focused on what they're doing. Humans are inherently self-centered, and I don't mean that in a negative way. But we're always thinking about what we're up to, and that's, you know, for obvious reasons. But you know, sometimes they'll come to you and they'll say like, look, this is the most critical issue I've ever experienced and this needs to be fixed now. And, you know, this needs, and like they're working with SharePoint 2001 and they're developing on XP and this is like 2011 or something, you know, like it's one of those things where, you know, everyone's own cases will vary, but, evangelism is one of those things where I think people take the connotation of evangelism to be a religious aspect, which I don't, obviously, but it's just a you know, an evangelist is a bringer of news, if you will, good news, and in that vein, basically targeting technology.
But, you know, I do find it to be healthy, even though it's frustrating to, like, be that interface, because I think all of our jobs, there's also a component of it, which is not just bringing news to the outside world, but then also bringing the feedback and the interaction that you have back to the product teams. And so, you know, like, you can talk for a while about, here's this great new feature we've got, and then talk to people at a break and they say, we can't use that because of X, or, you know, that's great, but I'm having this trouble with this thing that you shipped in the past and I'm not ready to trust this, or, you know, whatever it is. And so there's, you know, I think there's a lot of, like, healthy, you know, interaction. And then hopefully you're working with a product team, you can bring that back to and say, hey, we really need to fix this story, or we need to have, you know, something to improve this experience or something. Right. Do you end up doing that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you nailed it on the head. There's what I call external evangelism, which is basically where you're talking directly to customers. And then there's internal evangelism, which is you're representing the customers in out there who are struggling with whatever technology that you've provided. And they need that. Those product team needs that feedback. So you're absolutely right.
You know, all three of us have been doing this for a long time, and I think all three of us have had the experience where you'll get two questions in a row, and one will be just dead simple and straightforward, and you have that great pleasure of helping somebody getting started, and the other will be so obscure and arcane that your eyes roll back in your head and you know, you start to froth at the mouth. And it's a fascinating position to be in, because I think you hit it, John, when you said that you're expected to know, I guess I'll ask you, John Bristow, is how do you keep up? How do you keep up enough knowledge and information to be able to know all the things that folks hope you know?
Oh God, I don't. You know, I think there's something I have to tell everyone, which is all the developers who are listening to this, don't worry. You're not alone. Everyone struggles with keeping up. So even the folks who purportedly are you know, at the top of their game, they struggle as well. Everyone has their inner idiot who's telling them, you know, look, I think Hanselman nailed it, where he talks about being a fraud and all that sort of stuff. You exactly have that feeling all the time, even though you have years of experience doing exactly what the question is related to. So
any minute you'll be found out.
Yeah, exactly. So to answer your question more directly, I mean, I look at it the same way I look at physical fitness, which is you incur a huge chunk of technical debt when you get into the business. It's like a minor down payment on this huge mortgage you're about to pay off when you first get into the industry. But if you chip away, just like with physical fitness or mortgage, if you chip away just on a rigorous sort of schedule, maybe monthly or whatever, you can keep up. And so what I do is I have a cadence that I try and follow on a daily, even hourly routine, where I'm just checking, you know, checking to make sure that I'm aware of what's happening on a news basis. So I'm keeping aware or abreast of what's happening in the industry. I'm also obviously following the folks that I look up to and read about. I don't buy books so much anymore. I read a lot of blogs and I follow social media that way for a variety of reasons. I feel that there's a lot of stuff that's really well worth reading about that's online, that's one of the major ways I keep up. Podcasts are another great way that allows you to multitask, even though scientists tell that multitasking is an impossibility, especially for males. But you know, I'll mow the lawn, for example, and I'll listen to a podcast at the same time. And even if it's kind of unconscious in terms of listening, if you're a passive listener, some of it still sinks in. There's a phrase or a nugget that will come out of there that I'll be able to pull out later on as something that I was referencing in a conversation, for example. So my you know, everyone's strategy is different. My advice to anyone listening to this is, you know, follow a cadence or try to strive for some balance that is comfortable for you. For a lot of years before evangelism, I was a consultant, and You know, you go into these organizations where they have firewalls and IT policies, and you can't look at certain sites like, you know, Hanselman.com would be blocked, for example. I couldn't read Scott's blog, you know. So, you know, a lot of the time is, yeah, after work hours. So I would check before and after work hours if I was working with a customer, for example, on site. So it's hard. It's not easy. It's, everyone struggles with it. But don't worry, you're not alone. And we're kind of like a virtual support group for each other. By sharing that knowledge.
Let me zero you in on an area that you are particularly passionate about, which is HTML5. And I know John Galloway is also extremely involved with HTML5. Mm-hmm. Where do you enter into HTML5? What's your touch point with that? Why is that particularly of interest to you?
I'll start at the beginning, which was, you know, when I first got into this industry, I did what a lot of folks do when they first get into the industry, which is they hack. And I was hacking on angle brackets. So this is late 90s. I was in computer science courses, learning Java, using Swing, which was awesome. And also this web thing was kind of taken off. I have actually bought that Learn HTML in 24 Hours book back in the early 90s. Mid 90s. That was popular. I bought that book. And I wouldn't say that was my formal foundation for my learning, but I was always attracted to the web. And ever since that time and progressing now to 2013, I've been consciously, you know, watching what's been going on. I've been building apps. I've been building sites. I've had a great time doing it. I think that the web today is at a really good point. I think that, you know, there's a lot of momentum behind it, which is great. I think that there's a lot of possibilities that are just unobtainable in other domains or disciplines, and I think it's just universal. It's one of those just opportunities that just don't come around every so often. So I love the web for that reason. HTML5 in particular, I think, is finally a realization that, you know, the sort of hacky way that we've gone about standardizing angle brackets isn't really working, and that you've seen the sort of the attrition that's occurred. You know, there's these like developers scattered across the web developer battlefield, bloody and suffering from all the years that we suffered without, you know, a rationalization or standardization around markup. And so now with HTML5, I think, you know, given the fact that it's a living document, that it's constantly being improved, I think, you know, we're close to ratifying 5.1. I think this is all good stuff. And I think what you're now starting to see is the reason why I like this a lot is because it really does show the potential of what's possible on the web to the end users, to the non-technical folks, my mom, your dad, etc. They're starting to use applications that are just phenomenal. And you know, I can't wait to see what's coming out next. And I think HTML5 is part of that vision of delivery. So I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing. I think that we still have an incredibly long way to go. You know, we're not done yet. And I think that we're just opening sort of the door into what's going to be capable in the short term and as well as on the long term. I think that the last thing about this is that our paradigm will shift a little bit with the evolution of networks. So you're starting to see fiber rolled out, not only in the U.S., but also fiber to the home throughout many parts of the world. And that's going to open up a whole wealth of new types of apps that can leverage the full bandwidth that's available to end users. So there's new types of apps that we have to envision. I'm not saying it's going to be, you know, VRML days, but it's going to come. It's going to be something that's kind of, you know, Johnny Mnemonic like, where you're going to be using the web in very interesting ways. So,
and let me get a little bit more concrete with you.
Sure.
When we talk about HTML5, I think that there are a lot of developers who believe that they have some understanding of HTML, but not mm-hmm. necessarily HTML5. And mm-hmm. and why there is all this excitement about HTML5 and what's different in HTML5 from what came before.
Right. So HTML5, I think, you know, brings to the table some fundamental pieces that were always available, but were either siloed into technology, like, for example, Flash and Silverlight versus Canvas, for example, which is a basically a 2D drawing surface, a 2D API in JavaScript. There were also like these polyfills that you had to implement for certain features, SVG support, for example. A lot of these things kind of get thrown into the mix for this sort of banner of HTML5. I don't care what we call it. I think it's just the modern web is another phrase that I like to use from time to time. But in terms of the what's possible today, I think, you know, things that are exciting there are obviously Canvas. WebGL is particularly interesting as well. There's some phenomenal work that's being done there. There's some other aspects, though, that are needing some work. So, for example, I spent a lot of time talking to customers about building mobile apps using HTML5. And one of the domains or disciplines that is coming into light is this sort of native versus web approach for mobile apps. And the sort of refrain that I've used before, which I feel speaks to a lot of developers, is it's not a binary sort of decision. When you're building a mobile app, you don't need to worry about whether it's just native or just web. There's a spectrum, if you will. And then in that spectrum is this sort of hybrid environment. And the reason why I mention this is because there's a lot of work being done in this area around what are called device APIs, which is the ability to expose things like notifications and contacts and calendars and things like that to running applications in a web context. And so frameworks like PhoneGap Cordova are great for that. They provide this app container that you can use. So that's one aspect that's you know, needing some work there. The device API working group as part of the W3C is trying to work towards that. And then there are other things as well, like file access is a little bit clunky right now. You know, there's the file API there, which is okay, but it's not universally supported. I mean, you can just go to something like, you know, caniuse.com and see, you know, how we're still along this path of ratification of specs. And but I think it's all encouraging. You know, I think we're on the right path here. I think what we're seeing here, it speaks nothing but goodness. And I think that's the evolution of the web. It has to be iterative. It has to be sort of this march towards something that's, you know, I may not get to the mountaintop, but I'm you know, I'll help you march up there. Sort of approach. And I think it's a good thing. I think developers today will look back at this time and realize just how interesting this time was we were living in when building these types of applications.
Let me jump in and ask you about other areas that you're particularly interested in. Is sure. HTML5 the focus, or do you have other areas that you really spend your time and energy on?
Yeah, like so kind of similar to HTML5 is also this realization that we as developers are kind of screwing up a little bit. And I'll back up by talking about this website that I'm a huge fan of called the HTTP Archive. The HTTP Archive was created by Steve Souders of Google. Sorry, that just rolls off the tongue now these days, of Google. He's part of the performance team at Google. He used to be at Yahoo. He created this website. If you go to it, it's htparchive.org. It's similar to the Wayback Machine, where, you know, you have this sort of crawling mechanism robot that will go across the internet and basically hit these top sites. And it will basically aggregate the content of those websites. And so it will tell you, you know, what was a page made out of, but more importantly, it will tell you things like what was its page speed score, what were some of the aspects of the page that were slow, what were some of the aspects that could have been, you know, improved. And what's interesting are all these stats that derive out of that. So what does the overall internet look like from a development perspective? And so the reason why I go down this route is because I wanted to explain that web performance is one of the things that I've always been interested in. You know, how are we doing as an industry from a development side in terms of performance? Because as you guys know, when you have a slow web, it sucks. Like, you know, surfing the web when you're, you know, let alone on 3G or even worse, it's just a horrible experience. And, you know, if you want data and information at your fingertips, you expect it to have low latency. So web performance is something that's of a side interest of mine. I spend a lot of time with developers talking to them about it. So the HTTP Archive is one of those aspects. And what concerns me recently is just the growth in terms of the average web page today. So an average web page that you'll hit today, on average, is about 1.4, 1.5 megs in size. 1.4, 1.5 megabytes in size. Now, you guys, you and I are old enough to remember when we were on dial-up modems, And that was just an impossibility. Like, that would take 20 minutes to download.
I'm old enough to remember acoustic couplers. Thank you very much.
There you go. So, you know, this is, but, you know, fortunately we have broadband and it's getting a little bit better, but still I still can hit sites on a slow enough connection that's considered modern. I'm using air quotes when I say that I can see progressive image loading of the site itself. That's not a good thing. And it's even worse when we consider mobile sites and even sites that are being hit from outside, say, the US or Australia. It's just not a very good place to be. And so,
especially, people think about with mobile, like, well, I'll just, use responsive web design and throw CSS on there that's just going to hide a lot of stuff. But a lot of that is still downloaded, a lot of those things. So it's like you're just downloading it and hiding the problem. And then, developers in large metropolitan areas, well, it's going to work great on their LTE phone, 4G, whatever. And then you get, like you're saying, you get elsewhere. Not only do you have to worry about the download time, but also the cost, like if you're roaming or if you're in an area where that data is more expensive, it can run up a bill.
Yep. You're exactly right. It's not a good place to be. And so recently I gave this presentation entitled the Need for Speed at a conference in Perth, which is here in Australia. And the purpose of that presentation was just basically to talk about things like responsive design and to kind of make developers aware that, yes, it looks good and it's adaptive, but it has a side effect, which is, you're downloading a lot of stuff that you may not ever see. And I'm very much focused on the practical side of things. So I like to focus on things like tools. I like to focus on tips and tricks. And so the focus of that presentation was basically to try and make developers aware of the fact that performance really should be a feature, as Jeff Atwood so eloquently stated back in 2011. And that if you're a large enough organization, there is a tangible and real effect that a slow website has to your bottom line. So if you have a slow website, for example, and the sources are, there's a variety of surveys you can read on this, but basically a 1 second delay in page load time for a large enough organization can result in a loss of millions of dollars in potential sales. So everyone's heard about, if Amazon really tried to optimize its site to make it more performant, they were able to shave, I think the stat was about 100 milliseconds off its site, and that increased revenue by 1% for every 100 milliseconds that they shaved off the load time for a page. Like that's a phenomenal return on investment, if you ask me. You amplify what that means to a business, the performance really should be considered as a feature. But as you were saying, John, like one of the things that we're seeing now with responsive design, while it's great and it's adaptive and you've got things like, fluid layout and you've got media queries and blah, blah, blah. One of the challenges there is that you're actually loading more images than necessary in some cases. And so it can be a challenge. And so developers need to be cognizant of that. In terms of web performance, the three things I tell developers, if you want to make your website faster, you just either make things smaller, you move things closer, or you load things more intelligently. And that's it. And so there's a variety of tools. The good news is there's a ton of tools out there. So back in the day when I was cutting websites back in the late 90s, none of this stuff existed. The kids these days, they have it easy. So there's so many tools that they can use today. They've got prescriptive guidance tools. These are like, they've got silicon telling them how to do a better job in terms of their web page performance. You no longer need to talk to a human or a consultant to figure out what's going wrong. And so you got everything from, JavaScript minifiers to generating sprite maps for CSS to image optimization. Image optimization really is the big one to me because if you take a look at the stats that are on the HP archive today, the real culprit there, the sort of the high fructose corn syrup of the web is imagery in the form of JPEGs and pings and GIFs and things like that. Those are the high fructose corn syrup of our obesity epidemic we're experiencing on the internet today. And the reason for that is because they are just ballooning in terms of an average web page. So there's a number of websites that you can go to that talk about this. I refer to the HP archive quite a bit because of the fact that it actually does a good job of summarizing those statistics. But one of the sort of visualizations that I worked on was a page that I posted up on GitHub called Webpage Obesity. And so what I did on this, and but listeners can go and check it out if they want. But it's basically a visualization that shows how the internet has gotten fatter and fatter on an average web page over the last, say, 2 years. And images by far are dominating the spectrum of content. So it's not a good problem to basically have. We need a better way of actually loading these things. There are some responsive aspects that people are talking about. Like there's been a lot of talk in the design community about what are called responsive images. I don't know how that's going to play out. People are looking at modifying the image tag and defining various sources for loading. There are loading techniques as well that you can do. There's ways to fake loading and things like that. But I think we need to do something here because it is a problem.
Are there some simple things that J average web page owner or blog owner should be doing with images to keep down the size and to help with performance, or is it just more complex than that?
Well, yes. I mean, this is what I went into my talk. There are a ton of tools out there that you can use that will help out in this regard. So there are tools that help you better optimize your images. So oftentimes, developers will just use whatever the designer throws at them. And those images can be better optimized. Like, if you would be surprised to see the difference between, you know, a full high quality JPEG versus something that's been, you know, a little bit more lossy and is probably at a higher lossy level, at say 50%, for example. The quality of the image is still preserved. You can't really tell the difference, but the size difference is significant. So you can almost half the amount of size necessary to actually serve up that content. And there's some stupid things as well. Like, for example, when you use a tool like Photoshop, for example, tools like Photoshop and others will propagate metadata in the image format. So what does that mean? So you save an image as a JPEG, and then you save it to disk, and you put it up on your web server, and you just start serving it. If you were to actually look at and crack open that image and take a look at the metadata, there's like kilobytes of metadata that's useless. Like, you don't need this metadata in the image at all. It's saying things like, this image was created with Photoshop, or this image was created by such and such. Like, no meaningful data whatsoever to the end, to what the result is, which is just getting something drawn on the screen. There are other ways of getting around this as well. So, for example, serialization. So, data URIs, which is an HTML5-ism, serializing the data into basically a stream of bytes directly into the markup is another way of getting around this. There's just a ton of image tools as well. JPEG Tran, Ping Crush. Yeah, I'm forgetting the other ones as well. There's a new format being touted about by Google called WebP, which is very interesting. But yeah, there's just a ton of things that you can do to optimize your images. Sorry, John, I interrupted you.
Oh, well, I was just going to point out that your web page obesity is a very graphical page, and yet right. I don't see any images on it.
That's right. That's because it's actually done with SVG. So, So SVG is just another way of potentially getting around the problem. It may not be the best in certain cases, but you know, it is another alternative that you can explore.
It's just great to, you know, like, this is a great example of thinking of, you know, what are you really trying to present? And here you've right. got, you know, you've got vector graphics. I mean, these are things, and then because of that, it can scale well, and it's very lightweight, and it can be reusable, you know? I mean,
yeah.
It's a lot more flexible.
Yeah, I mean, SVG is good. I think that for sort of JRandom developer, it's tough, right? Because you either need a framework. No one's going to cut SVG by hand. It's just it's very esoteric, and it's very difficult to understand sometimes. So you're going to use a framework. Sometimes those frameworks can be difficult. There's a ton of frameworks out there that emit SVG, which is great. SVG is not always the best solution. But getting back to the more practical side of what you were asking, Jesse, was there's a wonderful tool that developers can go to today called jpegmini.com. And I think this kind of summarizes what I was talking about in terms of better optimization. So if you go to jpegmini.com, that's jpeg, J-P-E-G, as opposed to J-P-G, If you go to jpegmini.com, this is a very interesting example of why better optimization matters. So what you see on the page here, and I know listeners will have to go and do this themselves, what you'll see on the page when you go to that site is you'll see basically these images that are presented to you, and there's a slider that you can move back and forth. And what they're showing on the left is the original image, and on the right, an image that's been optimized using this tool. And this really speaks to the fact that, you know, optimizing your images really does matter in terms of web perf. Like web perf, it really does make a significant difference in terms of the amount of bytes necessary to transmit across the wire what it is you're trying to show on the screen. And so if you're trying to get around these problems of, you know, we've got a slow website, we need to impact the bottom line because faster sites mean more revenue, et cetera, et cetera. Image optimizations is it's a cheap and easy win. And the great thing is that there's a ton of tools out there, including this one, that you can use. And if you're extremely lazy, and I know that developers are, the good news is that there are tools that will actually, you can just put on your web server that will make things generally faster. So people have heard of things like Google PageSpeed and YSlow and things like that. These are sites that will inspect your pages and tell you, you know, prescriptively, this is what you need to do in order to make things faster. What folks have done now for Apache and Nginx and for IIS is you can actually get the equivalent of these modules that will just install on your web server and do all those optimization techniques without you having to do a single thing. So there's this thing called IIS Speed, which is for IIS, which you can install on your web server, which will basically take all your images, for example, and put them into a sprite map, or take all your JavaScript files and coalesce them into one download, because HTTP requests are extremely expensive. There's a very well-known framework for making ASP.NET websites better called Request Reduce. So these are things that are, you know, like I sound like an old man when I talk about this, but the kids these days, man, they got it so easy, you know, like it's something that I think developers can do a much better job of because of these tools that exist. And if they don't want to go down that route, that's fine. There's also boilerplates that they can use, like the HTML5 boilerplate, which does some really interesting tricks for loading JavaScript, for making sure that during a build process that images are crunched. So there's a lot of things that you can do as a web developer to make things better.
I'm looking at JPEG Mini, and it's extraordinary because you can see the difference between the two images. It's not obvious which way it's better, the original or the JPEG Mini, but the differences are quite subtle, and the differences in size and performance are not subtle. They're quite significant. So it's a fascinating site, and it also at least states that you can upload an unlimited number of images and there's no charge involved. So they couldn't make it much easier.
No, I mean, that's the point. You know, like these tools are available today, and you know, there's a lot of folks who are, you know, shouting from the rooftops, look, we've got to do a much better job as an industry to improve on the state of the nation, so to speak. We have an obesity epidemic on the web, and we as developers are responsible for that. And we need to go on a slim fast diet or, you know, start doing CrossFit or whatever we need to do in order to lose weight, as an industry to make the web a better place.
I just have to, you mentioned in passing, you mentioned Request Reduce, and I'm a huge fan of that because, like, it's just a drop-in thing for any, you know, legacy ASP.NET site, you just drop it in, it does that spriting, minification, bundling, and it's free, and it's like, why wouldn't you at least check it out, you know?
Yep. Yeah,
it's amazing. It's because a lot of these things take going and learning about, and you have to, I mean, it's not hard. But, you know, like you've got to say, okay, well, we're going to set up our bundling or our image minification or, you know, image optimization as part of a build step or as part of something to keep them up to date. Or you do it manually. Right. And then you've got to set up some, you know, different things. But there are also like the super easy way of doing this is you can drop something like Request Reduce in and it pretty much just goes, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I think these tools are wonderful, and I think that they'll carve up that 80-90% use case of developers just doing things not as efficiently as they could, and you know, with everything, there's a grain of salt to be had. But yeah, request reduce is wonderful for anyone who's targeting ASP.NET today. Certainly should be part of their arsenal along with other tools.
I'd be very interested in whether there's anything like this for WordPress, a drop-in widget or something that would have an impact on your WordPress blog or WordPress site.
There are page speed modules for Apache. There are also, I think one of the big problems with WordPress, I don't have a lot of experience with WordPress, but I believe that templates are a real problem with WordPress in terms of just the amount of garbage that WordPress emits into the markup. Mm-hmm. Really can slow it down. But you know, the one of the things you can do is if you don't know what you need to optimize, it's like anything else. The first thing you need to do is measure. So how do we measure? So we measure using tools. And what tools do we have? We have tools like IE. We have tools like Chrome. We have tools like Web Page Test, which is an online site you can go check out. And all of these will emit what are called HAR files. So HAR stands for HB Archive. And it's basically a JSON formatted document that basically, if it's rendered visually, will give you a waterfall tree view of how things are loaded in the network, on the network stack, if you will. And so the nice thing about this is that when you have this HAR output, you can start inspecting it and getting a better sense of, you know, when are things loaded, where are things blocked, and then you can use analysis tools like Web Page Test, which I mentioned earlier, Pingdom, which is another one as well. You can use these tools to start looking at where you might want to better optimize. So you mentioned WordPress. You know, if you fire up a network trace and you take a look at what's being loaded, you may start asking questions like, why am I getting so many templates if I'm only using one loaded in the browser? So that's one of the first things to do is to measure, because we won't know if we've improved or not.
You know, just what I use on WordPress, there are, like you mentioned, there's some great plugins. One I use is W3 Total Cache. And it can integrate with like Google Page Speed Report. It has a lot of like interaction with. It does some local caching, so like a lot of object caching and page caching. And then it also can work with services like Cloudflare that will do, you know, front end caching and set the cache headers and stuff, which is another great thing. You know, the setting caching. Then, you know, even if you do have a large image, it's only downloaded once, hopefully. You know, and then so you can minimize a lot of that traffic using proper caching stuff too.
So here's an interesting stat again from the HB Archive. Over half of the entire internet, or well, if you want to take it to that extreme, but over half of the pages that are crawled, and Steve and friends crawl about 290,000 URLs, so some of the top sites that are out there, over half of them have a cache lifetime of zero, the content. Zero. That means they don't use cache. So... You know, it's like one of those things, like, honestly, people, your image, your images, your JavaScript, even your markup is not changing as often as you think it is. Cache, please, for the love of God, cache, because it's going to make everyone's lives so much better.
And, you know, even having a micro cache of like seconds or, you know, like, I mean, for a lot of, okay, so if someone's going through a checkout process or something, maybe don't, you know, but the images in there, you can still cache, sure, you know, sure. And then like your homepage of your site, honestly, or a blog, you know, are you going to update it every second, every minute, you know, and it can make a huge difference on, like, I started looking into this partly because of not worrying about the performance so much, but I've got really cheapy hosting for the Herding Code site, and they they started bugging me about like, hey, you've got to upgrade your service because you're using too much CPU. And so I'm like, well, why don't I just crank up the caching like crazy on this and turn off the CPU? You know?
There you go. Yep, and even CDNs themselves will be intelligent about that. Your ISP will be intelligent about that as well. If they see caching headers in the requests, they'll store them even closer in some cases. So, yeah, utilize CD. I mean, these are old rules. Everyone's known about these forever, but it's amazing how often you see people trip up on this. I think a lot of people, they just kind of, I don't want to, you know, paint everyone with the same brush, but certainly a lot of web developers I see, they have this sort of throw a bunch of stuff up on the wall and see what sticks type attitude, because they don't really worry about these things. And I think, you know, if you read through Jeff Atwood's blog post that he wrote back in 2011 entitled Performance is a Feature, he really does do a really good job of explaining why this matters. Like, a lot of developers won't really care until they get the reasons why. They know how. The how is easy. We have tooling and things like that. But why? Like, motivate me emotionally why I need to do this. And Jeff does a wonderful job kind of parsing the landscape of reasons for doing this. And they really do boil down to, because it's going to make your company more money, because you're going to have happier customers, you know, any number of reasons that you care about. People care about rounded corners in CSS because they think that's going to improve the user experience. Honestly, you'd be better off spending more time trying to reduce the number of requests that you make and crunching your images, because that's what's going to matter. If you have a really fast, responsive site in terms of network, latency, that's what's going to matter to end users. Not the fact that there's like, you know, a box shadow or anything like that.
You know, an important thing too is I think the cumulative, like you've mentioned, the experience on the site, and I think it's important to like remember that somebody coming to your site is going to go through several pages of the site. Like you mentioned Amazon earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, loading up a page on the Amazon site, well, if that takes a second or two to load, I'm okay with that. But if clicking around the site, every single request is taking me seconds, I'm going to give up after a bit. But if it's like a smooth experience, I can, you know, spend enough time to buy a lot of stuff, you know, if it's not frustrating. And so it's very much like a cumulative, like a bunch of death by a thousand cuts kind of thing, if every single request is slow.